With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Sam Howlett, and today I'm joined by Jake Cunningham.
Hello.
Special episode. So you may have already heard our Good Time episode. It was released
today. Yep.
So this is an extra special episode as we'll be discussing Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool and Ingrid Goes West, as well as playing you some interviews we've had with the directors of those films, Paul McGuigan for Don't Die in Liverpool and Matt Spicer for Ingrid Goes West.
Yes, and so we got ahead of ourselves during a recent film festival and recorded as many interviews as we could, failing to think about when these films are coming out.
And fortunately, three of them released on the same week.
Yes.
Which is really helpful.
Yeah. I mean, it's extremely helpful for us for recording and editing purposes, but perhaps you as listeners, this is great because you get three great interviews.
Definitely. Okay, let's start with, should we start with Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool then?
Yes, and this is a film I've actually kind of, I've warmed to more than I've thought about it.
Okay, do you want to give us a bit of a plot?
Yeah, so this is about Gloria Graham and Peter Turner. So Gloria Graham was an actress and she was big in the kind of film noir time, 30s, 40s. She was a bit of a femme fatale character. People might recognize her as the kind of flapper dancer girl from It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
But she's been in lots and lots of things, and she, at the later end of her career, she moved to England where she was doing theatre, and at that time met a chap who was living in the house share she was in called Peter Turner, who was a Liverpudlian, and they kind of got into a relationship, and Peter got swept up in her kind of world of old Hollywood and went out to America with her in New York and LA and showed her Liverpool and London. And it's a burning, intense, short romance is what it is. And we're just given a glimpse into that short time period that they spent together.
Okay, so this is Jake's interview with Paul McGuigan. Enjoy.
So we're delighted to welcome Paul McGuigan onto the Curzon Film Podcast to talk about Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool.
Hey, how are you?
Yes, I'm all right. I want to start off with asking you about adaptations. So for you, where this story came from, was it a case of finding the book, the script? Was it just an idea that someone told you?
I was actually at a screening of a friend of mine's film, and a producer called Colin Vaines, who I've known for quite a while and who I was working with for a while, saw me across the room and he looked at me in a strange way and I was like, why is he looking at me like that? And he came over and he goes, you're the guy. I don't know why I was thinking about it. You're the guy. And so he talked about this project he had. And he mentioned that Barbara Broccoli was a producer. And Barbara and I had been in touch with each other over a couple of projects before. So we knew each other very well. And he just gave me the script. And he gave me the book at the same time. So I had the pleasure of, when I travel up from London back up to Scotland, I take the train so that I can read scripts and read books and stuff. And so I read both on the train up. I mean, the book's tiny, so it's just a little book. But what I loved about it was so small, and it was just all the highlights of a relationship, but it was so condensed and so beautifully written, and the script kind of stayed on par with it, you know. And I just thought it was a beautiful, very moving piece of work without being sentimental because it was a real story about real people. And then, of course, Gloria Graham, I knew of, In a Lonely Place is one of my favourite movies and was one of my favourite movies before I did this. It certainly is one of my favourite movies now that I've done this film. And so I was very aware of her, and I was kind of aware a little bit of her backstory and her life. But what I liked about the film was it was over a 3-year period. It wasn't a Gloria Graham biography, you know. It was the film about this love story.
And when you get given a book and a script at the same time, do you read one, then the other, or do you start on the book and you think, oh, I've got to see how they visualise that?
No, I did the opposite way, actually. I read the script because ultimately that's what I'd be working on. And then I read the book, and there were some things in the book that I thought should have been in the script, and we changed it as we went along with Matt, the screenwriter. And I wanted to work with Barbara Broccoli. I've always wanted to work with her, and she's just a wonderful human being and a great inspiration.
Well, I've got to ask about that, because that's not a name you're expecting to see pop up that often outside of a Bond film. So how did that happen?
Well, she was friends with Peter Turner. She's been friends with Peter Turner since she was 17 years old. And she was her that actually sort of tried to convince Peter to write his story down in a book. And so she's been trying to make the film for 20-odd years. I mean, if Barbara Broccoli, it takes her 20-odd years to make a movie, then you know that she's very passionate about it. And when the screenplay came up, she took the rights to the screenplay and she got Matt to work on it. And it's been a labour of love for her for a long, long time.
Yeah. So when you're casting a film that is about a film star that is very recognisable, that's got to be a humongous challenge.
Well, I don't know how recognisable she is, to be fair.
But yes, I see the photo at the start of the film.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I thought that was really neat by
you. No, we it's interesting because this was 1978 when Peter first met Gloria, and it's the pre-Google days, obviously. So, you know, obviously the film would have been over very quickly if he could just Google her and find out about her, you know. So when you say she's recognisable, I think you're right in one respect. Is I think when you go retrospectively into her world, you kind of go, oh, that's that woman that was in there. She's not got that face that you think, or that, I mean, maybe the face, but she doesn't have the name, I think, that you'd recognise straight away. So I've never done a movie about a real person before, you know, somebody who actually lived and breathed and who just recently passed away. So that was a big challenge, but it wasn't something that we could ever... When I met Annette Bening, for instance, we never talked about, well, we've got to do this for Gloria or we've got to do this for Peter. We just have to tell the truth. We just have to be honest about what happened and what the film's about. I mean, certainly didn't want to make a sentimental journey into the past, you know. It's not about an old lady dying in a room. It's not about a film star who's you feel... It's not like, you know, the film star who still replays all her movies out, you know. Didn't have that edge to it. It was just an honest... as I said before, a very condensed love story that I think was important to tell. And of course, her being a big star, that brought its own baggage with it, and that's what the movie kind of deals with, you know. The fact that, you know, she didn't want to lose her hair to get treatment, and, you know, and it's the things that the women still have to put up with these days, you know, and it's very relevant now to these days. I think Gloria would have been the first person on Twitter. She would have got the first Twitter account for sure. And she would have had something to say about this male-dominated world that we lived in, because that's basically what killed her career, you know, was that Hollywood just couldn't deal with her personal life. It couldn't deal with her crazy personal life that she had, you know, and so she went out of favour. So it's nice to make a film with Annette Bening that celebrates a woman of a certain age who's still sexual and still incredibly present and still can be misbehaved and still can stay up with the best of them and be young, you know, and I think that's important.
Yeah, and, well, something that I really liked about it is that if in another film you switched the genders of the two lead characters, that age gap wouldn't be commented
exactly,
on.
Exactly, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because... it's very true, and that's what scandalized Hollywood, because she was fond of her young boys for sure. And we know that, right? That's a part of her own personal history. And it's interesting. And it wasn't until we did the film, actually, it was weird, because we never during the film of it thought, oh, let's make a kind of film that celebrates a woman of a certain age. You know, it was just celebrating Gloria Graham, and suddenly you realise that how powerful she was as a woman and how strong she was as a woman and how modern she was and as an actor, you know. And she could go toe-to-toe with the best of them in Hollywood, you know. She was married to Nicholas Ray, for God's sake, you know. She was, you know, in the big heat, you know, she'd go toe-to-toe with all these guys and all these big shaw, all these very misogynist men. And there she was, you know, still giving it sass at the end of the day. And that's what I loved about her as a character, about Gloria Graham as a character, you know.
Yeah. And the what's really lovely is that all the people that you surround them with in the film, bar maybe her sister, are completely into this relationship as well. It would be so easy for the previous generation mother and father to be up in arms about this, but everyone is just so caring.
I think, you know, and I don't want to sound too romanticism about working class life in the UK and all that, but I think there's something about that close-knit families that they will always, you know, if you come back with a girl or a boy or whatever, they'll be like, they'll stand by you, they'll stick with you, they'll, if he loves her, that's good enough for us, you know. That's the kind of mentality which I think is really good, and I think that's what Gloria craved later on in her life. She never had that. Her family was so kind of fractured and all over the place that I think that her being in Liverpool was really important for her at the end of her life, you know, that she really needed that and craved it and felt. Even though her family, she only had known Peter for 3 years, that was a big important part of her later life, was to know that family and know how much they did accept her, you know, and didn't judge her. You know, that Bella never judged Gloria. She never, you know, Peter's mum never judged her.
Yeah, well, that was one of my favourite tiny little moments in the film, is when we go into the bedroom with Bella and Gloria, and they're just having a cup of tea, and they just look like they've been friends for about 50 years.
I know.
Yeah, I imagine for you that must have been quite an amazing moment to just put Annette Bening and Julie Waters in bed.
I've actually got a picture of me in between them in bed as well.
Yeah,
it's nice. You can't miss a part. Like, yeah, no, the whole film was like that actually. Julie Waters, I've been an amazing fan of for years, and everyone came to this with such a love for the story and such a genuine understanding of what the story really required and what it needed, you know. And so, yeah, it was wonderful. And, you know, Annette Bening and Julie Walters became instant friends. So that scene in the bed was them actually having a laugh. I just shot whatever was happening, you know.
Yeah.
And there was lots of that in the film where it was just them cracking up or, you know, just adding bits in. And, you know, it was a good time.
So through the film, we kind of journey into the past via memories that you transition in between them really love. It's quite theatrical.
Yes,
But the memories, in a way, to me, feel like they are a bit more traditionally cinematic in how they've been shot and put together.
Yeah, I mean, my overall, when I came to this story, I really had one big idea, which is more than I normally have, but the big idea was really that to understand the fluidity of memory and to visualize it, you know. So the idea is, because memory's not a cinematic, it's not really cinematic memory, you know, if you think about it. It's not, you don't go outside and you have a big wide shot of the establishing shot of the place, and then you go into another wide shot and, you know, or a two shot or something. You can't do that. So to me, I wanted the sets to unveil itself into the memory, or for the characters to walk through memories, you know, to go from. So we actually quite literally had characters jumping out of bed and going through a hole in the wardrobe and appearing in another scene, you know, straight away. There was no cuts in it, you know. So we did it all through the camera. And it is very theatrical, but it's deliberately done like that, you know.
I thought maybe, is there a reason, because there's bits when they're driving or when they're looking at the sea, and it just looks like maybe something from when Gloria first did a film in colour.
I'm glad you said that. Actually, that's good. You're the first person to notice that. Okay. Thank you. Well done. You get a gold star for that.
Brilliant.
We tipped our hat. We didn't want to tell Gloria's backstory, but we definitely wanted to make the audience feel like they were in some kind of 50s movie, you know. And so, yeah, the beach scene, for instance, is from In a Lonely Place, with Humphrey Bogart and her sitting on the beach, and I just wanted to do that beach shot because I always thought those beach shots are always a bit kind of weird, right? And really wonderful back projection, and we actually did it so well that people don't even notice this back projection. But we wanted to pay homage to that, and then the driving scenes back projection, it's all through the camera, and they in Gloria's apartment in New York, slightly a little grander than probably it was, but we wanted to do a homage to the apartment in The Big Heat, where she gets a coffee put over her face. So hopefully nobody even notices that, but I do, you know, I'll enjoy it.
Yeah, but I don't think that even if people do, it's part of the charm of the film. If you do know that, yeah, then that's part of it. Another film that does get referenced in this is Alien, which is not what I was expecting. And I was wondering whether there was maybe a personal connection for you, and maybe was there scenes, a recreation of your cinematic memory of Alien?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's one of my first cinematic memories of coming out and going, I would love to do that, you know. That was just a film that just blew me away, you know. Yeah. So, but I also remember there's a funny date movie, you know, because it was that kind of movie. You knew that the girl would grab onto you at one point, you know. So we wanted to use that. That was a nightmare trying to get that clearance. You know, we had to clear every single person in that whole scene, everyone. So you can imagine getting the clearance from all these amazing actors, and they were very generous and they gave us it. But that's the power of having Barbara Broccoli as your producer. But
It's. You forget how scary at the time the chest burster must have been, because Jamie Bell's character just dives right in.
Totally. And yeah, I know it goes the wrong way, because she's so into it. She's like, oh, blood and guts everywhere. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, and also, you know, I think it's interesting because, you know, the alien thing is to me, it is kind of paying homage to that time, and it puts you on a date right away, you know. It's nice to do it through cinema rather than just in the music terms, you know, to do it something like that. Really cool.
Paul McGuigan, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks. Cheers.
Okay, Paul McGuigan there.
Yes, he actually gave me my first ever... no one else has mentioned that before.
Wow.
Which I was really pleased about, because there's actually some really nice use of rear projection. And if you've heard the interview, which if you're listening to this...
You definitely have. Unless you decided to skip 15 seconds.
But we talked about that in the interview, but this idea of kind of doing old-style cinematic memories using older techniques like rear projection for the cars and for the beaches. I was quite pleased with that.
Excellent. Well, good shout on your part. This is a really nice film, isn't it? Because you think in this film about... I mean, it's got a pretty depressing title.
Yes.
And it sets it up as a kind of tragic romance, which it is. But you assume with this kind of film that the age difference is going to be an issue. And it never is.
No.
There's not really a character that thinks, what is he doing? What are you doing with her? What are you doing with him?
Mm.
Not really. It's not a plot point that that's an issue.
Yeah.
And their love feels very genuine.
Yeah. And so weirdly, Barbara Broccoli is a producer on this film, who knew Peter Turner and Gloria Graham at that time, and said that even during that time, no one thought of it as an issue as well. It was just never.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just I think that goes to show just how natural their relationship must have been.
Yeah. Paul McGuigan was about a year ago, he was a favourite to direct the next Bond.
Right.
Maybe just because of this association with Barbara Broccoli.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's got an interesting track record. He's got some odd stuff.
Varied career.
Yeah. He says that his next project, he's directing a few episodes for an Amazon series that was... originally developed by Guillermo del Toro. So he's really kind of...
Yeah.
Like, I find that like it's kind of in a way got that Ang Lee nature to him, in that just throw himself into anything.
Or Ridley Scott, don't stick to one genre, don't stick to one style, just do everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
But this is a really sweet film, and it's really contained. It doesn't try and be about anything more than it is, and reach into Hollywood and fame. And it does touch on those things, but it's really focused on the romance.
Yeah,
that's the heart of it, and I like that it doesn't stray into anything else.
And also Annette Bening, at this stage in her career, to do the sort of two punch of 20th century women and then this is very impressive.
Mm.
And I think this is the best she's ever been in her career.
Yeah, she's excellent. At this stage,
Gloria Graham, I never knew this story. I was vaguely aware of Gloria Graham, but I had no idea that any of this actually happened. Really sweet film. Do check out Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool. Also out this week then is Ingrid Goes West, which you haven't seen.
I've not seen.
I have seen. So this is, the best way to describe it would be, as I'm sure a lot of people have, and I may be stealing a soundbite from someone, but I'm going to say it anyway. It is a single white female for the Instagram generation. Which is
so a lot like your life.
Basically, yes, my life. Yeah. but where in that film, the stalker victim was the protagonist and the stalker was the antagonist, the roles are reversed here. So we follow Aubrey Plaza as Ingrid, who is obsessed with Instagram, and she kind of attaches herself to these people that she finds on Instagram and wants to be their best friend, loves their life. And her latest fixation is Elizabeth Olsen's character. And Ingrid becomes so obsessed with her that she moves to all the way to LA to be with her and to befriend her and copy her lifestyle. So the film has this, it's more comedic than Single White Female. Like, Single White Female is in many ways a horror film. This is not that. This is sort of as a dark comedy, and it treads the fine line between the sort of mental health drama and the comedy. And I think it pulls it off.
As extreme ways as something like The Voice is, though.
Not in that level. I mean, yeah. We're not talking that dark, but it definitely goes to some places that I didn't think it would.
Okay, that's... Because that was my worry, is that I think there is a real issue about this perfection lifestyle that social networks have created and that people adore and really do get intensely fixated by.
Yeah. But no, I think this has a message as well. It has a purpose. And obviously I'm not going to spoil it, but the last scene is indicative of that, of everything the film is saying.
Okay.
So here is me talking to the film's co-writer and director, Matt Spicer.
Welcome to the Curzon podcast, Matt Spicer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the kind of Instagram culture that you show us in the film, it's only a few years old, really. So how long ago did you get this idea, and how long ago did you start writing the script?
We started writing the script in May of 2015, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that long ago. And it came pretty quickly. I mean, we came up with the idea and then started writing it, and I'd say we sent it out to actors in November of 2015. That's when Aubrey came on board, and then we started shooting it last summer. So it was, it's been almost a little over 2 years from when we came up with the idea to when the movie's actually coming out in theaters, which is pretty crazy.
Quite quick. Especially
in the film world, that's very fast.
Yeah, absolutely. So are you on Instagram yourself?
I am, yeah.
Okay, and how do you find it compared to Ingrid?
God, I mean, I don't have any Ingrids yet that I know about. It's funny. It hasn't. My social media life hasn't changed that much. I have a few more followers now than I did before the film. But I don't. I don't really post that much. I'm more of a consumer of it, and which is why I think the Ingrid character. I felt more like a voyeur, more like a stalker myself using the app. And so I related more to that character than the Taylor character, because the idea of putting my life out there to that extent as she does makes me feel very uncomfortable. I wouldn't like to do that.
did the character come first, or did the idea come from you looking at Instagram and just?
I think it was the concept. You know, it honestly was one of those kind of, Dave and I were having, my co-writer and I were having lunch, and we were kind of talking about, oh, wouldn't it be funny if there was a, like a talented Mr. Ripley or King of Comedy, but with social media and like a social media star. And, you know, I think that idea kind of made us laugh. And then I found myself thinking about it for days after, being like, you know, there's actually something here maybe. And so I think we sat down again and started digging into it a little bit deeper. And that's sort of where the story came from.
Okay. So a lot of people have, and I think will still compare this to a single white female.
Sure.
But a character in the film points this out as well.
Right.
Was that in there for you to try and beat people to it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was, that was sort of how we, you know, whenever you're going to look for the money, it's like you want to, you need to be able to condense the idea down into something really digestible and that sounds commercial and marketable. So I think that was like our sales pitch was like, oh, it's single white female for social media. You know, it's like whatever. And then people's eyes light up and they see dollar signs.
Yeah.
But they're like, I think we always saw it less like that because that movie's, and again, intentionally so, that movie is more from the victim's perspective, right? And the stalker is the villain of the film. And I, you know, like I said, I find that I relate more to the voyeur and the stalker aspect. And so we thought it'd be interesting to sort of flip the script a little bit. And again, there's movies like Chuck and Buck, King of Comedy, Young Adult, and Townsend Mr. Ripley, which are more from the sort of sociopath's, you know, perspective, that I think are, it's more interesting to me to have to show the anti-hero, the other side of it, and to be force your audiences to relate to that, a character that maybe they wouldn't want to relate to.
Were you constantly kind of thinking about having to strike the balance between Ingrid being a hero and a villain? Like not pushing her too far, or where you kind of can just go for it?
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about like likability, you know, but I do think it's slightly sexist, slightly misogynist, because I think there's a lot of unlikable male characters out there and people don't kind of think twice about it. And then as soon as you have a female doing something that is, you know, like at all unlikable or unsavory, it's like suddenly people's like hair stands up on the back of their neck. You know, it's like, so I think, which also we were aware of too, that I think a lot of those movies that I named before have men as the you know, main character, and so we wanted, we're like, well, we don't need another male anti-hero. Yeah. Let's try something a little bit different.
And what about the balance between the kind of more thriller aspects, I suppose, of the film and the comedy? Was that a kind of hard balance to strike?
It was it was like a trial and error, I would say. But it, to me, the comedy was always there to, you know, to release the pressure valve, so to speak, because I think it's, you know, a lot of people watching the film, they're like, I'm so anxious, I'm like my stomach's in a knot the whole time I'm watching it. And the comedy, I think, provides a relief from that to a certain degree and makes it a little bit more pleasant, I think, of an experience. Yeah. Otherwise, it'd be unbearable. And so I also think the comedy provides like a nice Trojan horse for, you know, to make a film that people can talk about a kind of more serious issue.
Yeah. So I think like Audrey Plaza and Elizabeth Olsen are both perfect casting. Were they in your mind at all when writing it?
No, but we didn't really write it with anybody in mind. Okay. I think we wrote it, we didn't think that we were going to be able to get actors of that caliber. You know, I think we wrote it thinking, oh, we'll make this for, you know, a couple hundred grand if we can, you know, with our friends. But obviously, I've been a fan of both of them for a long time, both of theirs. And it was just, I was like, again, not expecting to that they would ever read the script and want to do it.
So yeah, you mentioned there that you kind of thought it would be this really low budget film that you just make with your friends. How was it when it suddenly kind of ballooned up into this higher budget, you know?
Well, I was really excited because I thought that I was like, oh, well, we'll have more time, more, you know, money. And but the irony is that I think it's still a small budget film and you never have enough time and you never have enough money, so it was always, you know, I think it's like you have more money goes to the crew, you know, to pay them an actual living wage. So it's like, you know, the money has a way of just disappearing regardless, I think, of the budget. And I hear that in people who've done much larger films, that it's just there's still not enough time or money.
What was it like then having your, you know, theatrical feature film debut be this big?
I mean, it's awesome. I really, it's, you know, you make films and you want people to see them, you know, so I think it's great. You know, I could not be more happy with, like, the fact that we got into Sundance and that it came out in theaters and all these things. It was all of our, my goals for the film have been exceeded and then some.
Awesome. So can we talk about two things that happened on set that I read about that delayed the production?
Yeah, I think I know what's coming,
So one of those was the Santa Clarita bushfire.
Yes.
And the other one is you walking through a glass door?
Correct.
Okay. Yes. How much did those two events affect the filming? Were you thinking, oh my God?
Well, it was more of just par for the course. I feel like every day there was some disaster that we had to deal with. And so the fire was just, you know, one more thing that we had to contend with, but it was like, but yeah, we had to evacuate the set, and then we hadn't even started shooting, so it was kind of, we got a 3-day weekend, and then we had to come back and obviously make it up later, which was a nightmare because we had to do a 6-day week. But me walking through the glass door was, you know, it was one of those things where it's just like, yeah, at the end of a long day, and we were shooting outside of this really nice, you know, postmodern house or whatever. Yeah. I guess, no, it's mid-century modern house. And they had shined up the windows really, you know, make them nice and clean because there were fingerprints all over them from everyone walking in and out all day. And I think I literally called cut and I just turned and just plowed right through. And I froze, thankfully. I didn't walk through. The glass was like raining down in front of me. And I just turn around and the entire cast and crew are all just standing there with their mouths open. Like they were like a poster for a Wes Anderson movie, you know, it's literally like the ensemble cast. And I just hear someone yell medic like from the back and then someone comes running out. And thankfully I only had this little, it was like, it's only like this big scar on my elbow, but that was it. But there was, I was bleeding. I didn't know where from or whatever. And so they rushed me to the emergency room and it was just 3 stitches. But you know, it's just, Aubrey pulled me aside the next day and she was like, thank God you broke through the door and you didn't just bounce off of it. Because she's like, otherwise I don't think anyone would ever respect you again on the set. I was like, I think you're probably right.
So yeah, you've mentioned that the film premiered at Sundance.
Yes.
But that's quite a long time, I guess, for the film to have its premiere and then kind of lay dormant for a few months. What are those months like when it's kind of, the film's done, people have seen it, but you've still got a while before it's all over?
It makes you very anxious. It's like, you know, but it's funny because I think we started then getting back out there in June. So yeah, I guess it was about 4 or 5 months of, you know, but it was good kind of in a way because it let me separate from it and to a degree and figure out what the next thing was going to be. But also weird because it's like now here I am like doing interviews in, you know, October. And so it's been almost, 8 or 9 months since. So it is very strange, that it takes, it's such a long cycle of like, it takes so long to get these things, but that's what it, you know, to get the trailer and the poster and all these things, it takes time to get that stuff right. So. Yeah.
The poster is incredible, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
Can you talk about like who designed that and your input on it?
Yes, I'm blanking on the company's name at the moment because we did have a couple, so I don't remember which one was the final company, but it was tricky because we didn't have, you know, being a low budget movie, we didn't have great on-set photography. Yeah. So, you know, we going with the animated poster allowed us, you know, to get all the characters in there without having to schedule a photo shoot, because trying to get all those actors in the same room together is, you know, a challenge. And, I think it was like, the movie kind of has like an 80s kind of vibe to it. And so I kind of liked the 80s vibe of the drawing on the poster. You know, it just fit the film for some reason.
And then finally then, you're writing the Rocketeer remake. Is that correct?
Co-writing it with Max Winkler. Yeah.
Yeah. And how's that going? What is it like writing for Disney?
It's great. I mean, I love working for Disney. I mean, you know, they're such a part of your childhood, everyone's childhood, I feel like. And but I loved the original movie and always kind of dreamed of making a sequel. And so when it came up as that, they were like, do you want to pitch on this? We jumped at it. And, you know, it's great. Disney knows exactly what kind of movies they want to make. You know, they're not, everyone knows what a Disney movie feels like and looks like. So we're just trying not to disappoint anybody. Yeah. You know, we want to make the best version of it.
Excellent. Matt Spicer, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, nice to meet you.
Cheers. Nice to meet you.
The reason it got a bit weird in the middle there is because we were stopped because they said, oh, a fire alarm's about to go off, which then did not happen. So we just carried on.
Was it because the conversation was just so hot?
So hot. They were like, oh, guys, you're going to sell the fire alarms. I can just see it happening.
Yeah, I could tell. It was pretty spicy.
Okay. And that is it for this jam-packed episode.
Well, double episode. So actually, if you're for some reason only listening to this one, do go back in time and listen to the Good Time chat about Good Time that you and Ryan had.
We had a very good time.
Oh,
no one made that joke.
Really?
Neither of us, because we're above you.
Yeah, that's true.
We knew it and we thought, that's too easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Good Time is also out now, along with Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool and Anger Goes West.
What a week!
What a week. It's a pretty good week.
It's a very good week.
And if you fancy staying at home, Good Time is on Curzon Home Cinema.
And also Paddington 2 is still out in cinemas as well.
There are other films.
No, there's not.
Justice League is out now as well.
Oh, yeah.
The reviews came out. As we record, the reviews came out this morning.
Yeah.
That's all the time we have this week. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.